Well, hello and welcome to Mind Your Mentality, where your minds matter. My name is Pete Costa, and I'm the Director of Training here at the Mental Health Center of Greater Manchester in Manchester, New Hampshire, and I'm your co-host for today's episode. I'm joined virtually by Gretchen Grapponi. She's a licensed independent clinical social worker and training consultant and researcher, I believe. And today we'll be discussing stigma and its effects on the whole person. Hi, Gretchen.
Hey, Pete. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you here. It's good to see you again. So, Gretchen, in terms of our discussion about stigma, how do you think language shapes perspectives and creates barriers?
Well, thanks for asking about language, Pete. And we should probably let the listeners know that you've seen me present on trainings about stigmatization in a variety of settings. So some of this may be redundant for you, but feel free to join in and add any of your perspective that you think would be helpful, okay?
Yeah, absolutely.
When people ask about language, I usually do an eye roll, but I'm mindful and I acknowledge it and that it's very judgmental. But the reason I do the eye roll is because language as a barrier, as I see it, is more about when agencies or people focus on, oh, let's just change language. That's all they focus on. And it's very performative. And just changing language and saying, oh, we can't call people crazy. Okay, we're not calling people crazy, so we're all set, right? When people or agencies do that, they're not making any behavioral changes or policy changes. Mm-hmm. So that's why I kind of roll my eyes. But I do tell audiences or people that I work with, I'll give you one slide for language, right? So yeah, don't call people crazy, you know, call people by their names, use first person, first language and all that. So that's one of my comments about language as a barrier. The other barrier, as I see it, to language is I try to encourage people to focus on the term stigmatization rather than stigma. Mm. And I started doing that several years ago. And the reason I do that is, especially in health professional settings, it's because so Dr. Lisa Boleg, who is she's a social psychologist, she's one of the top researchers out there in intersectional forms of stigmatization, but she makes the point that when we focus on stigma, we're focusing on and viewing a person or a group of people as tainted. Mm. And so the people who are being discriminated against are being seen as tainted. But if we really focus on or address stigmatization, we're focusing on dismantling the harmful behaviors of whoever is perpetrating the discrimination.
Interesting.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And it's a lot easier for people to focus on stigma because then they don't have to take responsibility for any of the stigmatization that they might be doing, or they might not be doing the stigmatization towards people with mental illness or substance use disorders, but when they notice it, they're not doing anything to stop it.
Okay. So like the action that comes out of the attitude.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It's interesting because I was thinking this a little bit more broadly, and I was thinking that like language is really powerful. I mean, I can think of individuals who have been able to garner great influence just with their command of language. And I think like if you've ever been inspired by like a political speech or a faith-based sermon or a good book, I think it's hard to deny the impact of the chosen words and how they're delivered. In a training I was doing the other day, I came across this psychology professor, Allison Ledgerwood. She's a psychology professor at UC Davis. She did this really interesting study with her researchers, and she brought together two groups of people. And now this was in a lab setting, but in the lab, they told one group about a surgical procedure. And when they were talking about the procedure, they emphasized the 70% success rate of the surgery. With the second group, they brought them in and same procedure, they told them the same information, except what they emphasized was the 30% failure rate. The group who was told about the 70% success rate loved the surgery, was very positive about the surgery. The group that was told about the 30% failure rate, they did not like the surgery. So they said, well, let's take this one step further. So they took the group that had originally heard about the 70% success rate, and they told them, well, you know, the flip of this is that 30% of people fail. And suddenly that group started disliking the same surgery. And when they went to the 30% folks who they originally talked about the failure rate and said, well, you know, the flip side is that 70% of people are successful, it didn't change their opinion. They were still negative. And for me, it really spoke to two things. I thought, well, you know, first of all, we are, I feel like as humans, kind of primed to notice and look for negatives. We have that negativity bias, probably because, you know, it's a self-protective measure, and somewhere along our evolution, we had to notice the bad stuff so that we could survive. The other piece of it is, I feel like if we are intentionally or unintentionally communicating about a group of people from like a negative or other standpoint, that really sticks with people. Like, it's hard to change that. And I feel like we're all swimming in this soup of communication from the day that we're born with messages about all sorts of people and things. So like, these messages are getting through, you know, getting into us through osmosis and shaping how we view the world. And like today, it's being repeated from every angle. You know, we're constantly bombarded with these things in media and repetition and so on and so forth. If there are negative perspectives about a group of people, it's easy to see how powerful language that's repeated and amplified in our conversations, like media and our laws and institutions, how this really could lead to barriers for some of those individuals, both personal and institutional. And so this role of language in general for me is just super powerful.
Yeah, and thanks for that explanation. And what, think about in today's climate, specific words we're not even allowed to say anymore, you know, and how that has affected the behaviors of healthcare professionals, of people who do research in you know, mental illness and substance use disorders. And I guess my point in saying, yes, we need to acknowledge language, but not only focus on it, is because I know of so many excellent, ethical people who work in healthcare now who won't say certain words because they want funding, right? So just think about how many grants were cut for, you know, for like HIV care, that type of thing. And my point in making this point is that those people, their attitudes are excellent, but their behaviors now, in not saying, not being able to say those words, are stigmatizing. So my point is, you can't always focus on just changing the attitude, because that's not what's always going on.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. You know, it brings us to this idea, well, what is stigmatization or stigma, and how does it actually affect people seeking treatment?
Yeah, and that's an excellent question, and there's so many answers. As you know, Pete, I really encourage people to not only focus on one type of stigmatization, but, you know, public stigmatization, self-stigma, that, you know, stigmatization that we put on ourselves if we have a mental illness or a substance use disorder, or other marginalized or oppressed identities. So for me, I have a lived experience of severe depression, but I'm also an openly gay woman. So for me, I have several identities where I experience stigmatization at times. So I have lived experience of severe depression, but luckily I found effective treatment for. But still, in talking about it and talking about, you know, some of the interventions that I've had for it, some are more stigmatized than others. I'm an openly gay woman, so I've experienced homophobia, you know, gender-based discrimination, that sort of thing. So we have to not only look at one particular type of stigmatization, but, you know, how are interlapping or intersecting forms of oppression affecting the person that's sitting in front of us, if we're a clinician, or ourselves, if we're providing treatment or in treatment, or how are those different types of stigmatization being perpetuated or addressed or assessed within the organizations that we work in?
Yeah. And I feel like, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, I really, you know, honor the work that you've done and research that you've done around stigma, but I feel like you can't talk about stigma with or stigmatization without also talking about prejudice and discrimination. They're sort of all related. In my mind, and I don't know if this is correct, may not be, but in my mind, I feel like stigma is like a cerebral thing. It's like a thought-based thing and these negative attitudes toward people that I perceive as other. But then I feel like prejudice, for me, feels more feeling-based, like negative feelings towards what I see as the other. And I feel like they feed off of each other. It's hard to not recognize like the feeding between the two. And then for me, it feels like if I'm having sort of stigmatizing thoughts about individuals and prejudicial feelings, that I'm going to act in a discriminatory way, you know, towards what I see as other. I'm a mental health first aid trainer here for the center, and we use this statistic in the course, which is based in research done by a gentleman named Philip Wang and his colleagues in 2004. They studied people in terms of people who didn't seek out mental health treatment, but who were struggling, and how long do they actually wait? And the research actually showed that people who struggle, who sort of wait to get into services, will on average wait 10 years. And I was like horrified about that. Not 10 years because there aren't service providers, 10 years because they're just not ready to walk through the door and seek help, largely because of stigma. Like, what does this mean about me? What are people going to think about me? What does it mean to have a diagnosis? What does that say about me? What does that say about my future? So I feel like stigma, and you know this from your research and the trainings that you have designed, stigma does result in worse outcomes for people.
100%. I think I've written about this in one of the articles I wrote, that stigmatization, the best, you know, at best, it makes you uncomfortable. At worst, it kills you, right? And so we wanted to circle back on the term prejudice. So a lot of the theory about stigmatization is that it starts to stereotype with, you know, an inaccurate belief about a group of people. And prejudice in that process is agreement with that stereotype. And then the final step is discrimination. So I see stigmatization as the discrimination. And that's why I focus on the stigmatization / discrimination. That's the exact same thing. But again, you could not be prejudiced. You could not agree with that negative stereotype, but you could perpetuate, you could discriminate because you don't want to speak out due to backlash or for whatever reason, right? So that's why it's, I argue that it's not always this, you know, you have a stereotype and a prejudice and then resulting discrimination. It's, you can have resulting discrimination or stigmatization without agreement with the prejudice for a variety of reasons. So oftentimes that's what it is. And that's in the stigma literature, that's kind of how it's posited.
Interesting. It's like a real big tangled knot, quite the mess.
It's so nuanced. One of the reasons why I really do challenge people to think differently about it, not just stereotype, prejudice, discrimination, is because it's so involved. There's so many systems, policies at the state level, federal level, local level. We have to have really nuanced conversations and step back and say, okay, what's happening here for a variety of different types of stigmatization, not just, oh, does someone not like people with mental illness or substance use disorders, and let's spend all this time and money, which is billions has been spent on trying to teach people to not dislike or fear people with mental illness and substance use disorders. And it just has not been super effective.
Mm. Yeah, I believe that your own training and your own research has really pointed to the fact that trying to change attitudes alone is not enough. Gretchen, I know that you've just briefly shared your own experience as a gay woman and as someone who has experienced depression, but can you share any stories related to overcoming mental health stigma?
Yeah, I mean, I think the broad answer to that is, you know, I'm here now talking about it with you, and I have been speaking out about my own experience with stigmatization I was one of the first cool kids to do it that I know of. But literally in 1995, I think I gave my first interview with a newspaper. But a long time ago, I dropped out of college because I'm not sure if you're aware, if you stop going to class and handing in assignments, you get kicked out. So I didn't drop out. I got kicked out of college. But it was because of depression. So super, super, super depressed. I tried some medications. One worked really well, but only worked for like 6 months. And then I tried a bunch of other stuff and I was severely depressed. And so I would go to my local library, Concord Public Library, and try to find any research about potentially effective depression treatments that I hadn't tried. I remember sitting in the Concord Public Library and looking through this big book, and it said that the most effective treatment for treatment-resistant depression, which was what I'd been diagnosed with, it was electroconvulsive therapy or shock therapy. And so I read that, and I remember thinking, that's so stigmatized. But I, for whatever reason, was able in that moment, and I remember this, I said to myself, Gretchen, you will never be ashamed. Mm. You will never be ashamed if you do this, right? So I said, you're never going to be ashamed, because I knew the, you know, the images in the media and just people's reactions to, okay, shock therapy, not usually a positive thing. But I said, I'm gonna try it. Luckily, my local hospital had electroconvulsive therapy, ECT, and I tried it, and it saved my life. One of the really cool things about it is if it's going to work, usually it works pretty quickly for people. Mm-hmm. And so it worked really quickly. So I think it's usually like three times a week for a few weeks. And by the end of the few weeks, I was sleeping through the night for the first time in my life. I had an appetite, could taste food. So it was like life-changing. The reason I bring it up is because why is that overcoming stigmatization? One, it's because, I'm overcoming a bunch of types of stigmatization, right? Overcoming self-stigmatization, right? Promising myself, I'm never going to be ashamed that I have depression. I'm never going to be ashamed that I had ECT to save my life, right? So that's self-stigmatization I overcame. Choosing to not be ashamed of it is overcoming public stigmatization, right? You know, I'm not going to be ashamed to tell people about it. I've stuck true to myself, and I've never been, you know, never been ashamed of having depression, never been ashamed of having ECT but also, you know, not being ashamed of being gay, not being ashamed of being a woman, mm-hmm. not being ashamed of being a social worker. Mm-hmm. Most of the time. We have stories, but we won't.
Gretchen, thanks for sharing that. I do appreciate that. And I appreciate the vulnerability it takes to share that. You know, I will share my own story. And it's funny because my own story is a bit of a journey that only relatively recently have I been truly able to embrace and share. And actually, Gretchen, you may or may not know this, but you were instrumental in my own story. I actually have come to realize at the ripe old age of 56 that I've experienced actually two bouts of depression in my lifetime. And one was in my sophomore year of college, and the other one was somewhere around the year 2004. Honestly, at the time, I don't think I fully recognized that I was depressed with the, I guess, a capital D, if you will. It was really only later that when I was looking back that I understood my experience. And in both of my depressions, I was able to basically scrape by at work or in school, but I just really collapsed at home. You know, I was extremely isolative. I was tired. I was either sad or anxious. And I spent a ton of time just kind of cocooned up in my bedroom in bed, and I found myself watching like the same movie or television shows kind of on a loop. If I was interacting with anybody, you know, if I had to be at class or school or whatever, I was often, I think I was either detached or pretty irritable. I think that's my go-to for depression is irritability and anxiety. In my college bout of depression, I had suicidal thinking. I didn't really directly act on the thinking. It was kind of like an unwanted house guest that was kind of like hanging around and you're kind of waiting for them to leave. But I did act in impulsive ways, which looking back could have really put me in grave danger. So it was almost like this sort of passive approach to living.
Yeah.
I was sort of like saying or feeling like, well, if I die, then at least I won't be suffering and I wouldn't have directly caused it myself. I think part of the reason that I didn't recognize my depression earlier on is that I believed that something was deficient in me. And, you know, and I think that this is related that as I grew up as a gay male in a hyper religious environment. Like my family was and still is to some extent involved in a very popular cult, you know, that preached fire and brimstone and really like truly despises gay people. The preacher would always be routinely talking about gay people as being reprobates and they're going to hell. And so I certainly experience stigma from my church and my family and my friends. And this was during like the mid 80s when the whole AIDS crisis was really just ravaging the queer community. And our elected officials were joking about it in the Oval Office and ignoring it because it was seen as killing off, I think, the undesirables, so to speak, right? So my depression in college, I think, was tied to my stigmatized identity as a gay male. And in our church, when I was growing up, things like depression were seen actually as a result of oppression by the devil. Or because you were, you know, sinful, or where if you just prayed hard enough, or if you were faithful enough, God would cure you. So I think I saw being depressed, you know, in and of itself as being a personal failing or of a failure of faith or a failure of willpower. And on top of this, the cause of the depression, my gayness, was a character and spiritual flaw. So you could understand why I might have been reticent to talk about my like sexual identity or my depression to like anyone or even acknowledge it myself, because it would expose all the worst things that I believed about myself and was told about myself from the people who were supposed to love me and value me. In 2004, when I had the second bout of depression, I don't think I recognized it because I had come out. I had already done the work of coming out and done a lot of work around accepting my sexual identity and who I was. But also at this point, I was a brand new licensed social worker. And I really feel like I chalked up my depression to like situational things. Well, it's because I ended a significant relationship and I had a geographical move that was stressful. And I think in my head, I thought, well, anybody who experienced a significant breakup or, you know, a life stressor would feel depressed and just has to, you know, power through. And perhaps I thought that I surely couldn't be clinically depressed because, well, I'm a licensed social worker. And after all, we're the helpers, not the ones who need the help, right? So there's all this like layers of self-stigmatization and stuff going on. Where you come in is that I recall my experience of you as a colleague was one of authenticity, that you have been someone who's been your authentic self. And I remember a conversation that we had around the stigmatization of actually licensed professionals in the state when they had to answer a question on the application for licensure. And I don't remember the wording, but essentially it was like, you know, do you have some sort of mental defect that you can't do your work? And you were outraged. And I remember that, and I carry that with me. You know, the second piece that's really led to my growth in this area is actually the research that you've done with the center and your development of the course responding to intersectional stigmatization. I just want to let you know that I have so appreciated that. I've carried those things with me, and that has made a difference in my own journey. So you just never know how you're going to impact somebody.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. And that's lovely to hear. And I think that's, you know, just another example. We were talking earlier about how have I overcome stigma. Being open and having the dialogue and doing these trainings and sometimes doing interviews and things. I was at a medical appointment. One of the people that worked there came in and said hi, and then he started to cry a little bit. And he said, I have been depressed my whole life, and I saw your interview, and it prompted me to go get treatment, and it worked. And it works. So, I mean, obviously, it reinforces, you know, my decision to speak out. But it's so, but yeah, you never do know. So probably someone listening to this podcast today, it's going to affect them, and hopefully it will affect people in a positive way. And, you know, someone gets prompted to seek treatment, hopefully they'll get the treatment in an effective way. I mean, from a place that provides effective treatment. But yeah, but talking about it and just, you know, being authentic, not being afraid. I mean, it's not about not being afraid. It's about, I was listening to music, trying to get grounded for this interview. And I didn't really have a playlist. It was just like on shuffle. And the song Brave by Sarah Bareilles came up. And so I don't know, you know, so if people know that song, I just listened to an audiobook by Sarah Bareilles, and she was explaining the story behind that song. And she said she wrote it for, I think a friend of hers who was a gay woman who was really struggling with coming out. And so, you know, in the song, Sarah urges her to be brave. I was like, oh, that's a good song for this, for this interview. It doesn't mean that you're not going to be afraid to ask for help, or be afraid to speak up when you see stigmatization. You know, there might still be fear, but you can still be brave.
I love that. Could you describe how you think the Mental Health Center of Greater Manchester creates a community of acceptance and understanding? I don't know if that's fair to ask you. I feel like I could answer some of that, but
I love this question. And I don't think we've told the listeners that I've been connected to the Mental Health Center of Greater Manchester for 19 years, because 19 years ago I started as an intern there, and then I worked for many years there. And then after I left, I still came back into trainings. And one of the things I love so much about the center is your willingness, the willingness of leadership to have difficult conversations. In my current work as a training consultant and an instructor, I so rarely see courageous institutions. And I love that I learned how to become a clinician, how to be a therapist, in a place that had courage. And the trainings that I do wouldn't have happened if I hadn't worked there, because talking about willingness to have difficult conversations, I've known your last three CEOs and most of your senior leadership, and that they're all approachable. I was never afraid as a little employee underling that pointing out that maybe we could be doing better in certain areas related to stigmatization, that I was going to get fired or anything. So that's one way that you promote so many good things and just health overall to not only clinicians, but to employees. The Mental Health Center, you all and I got a grant where you implemented a plan for assessing and addressing several different types of stigmatization. You required all poor employees to attend my training. I did so many trainings, and it was awesome, and people are so amazing. And you did what's so important. Another thing that institutions that are courageous do: assessments. They measure outcomes, and they share the outcomes not only with staff but with clients and with community. So you all did that. I think we did like a 6-month process of doing assessments, doing trainings, doing post-training assessments. And we were able to show that we decreased a couple different types, like perceived stigmatization and maybe self-stigmatization among the staff. And then we ended up having a open free community training where we presented all the data, which is super brave. You know, you don't see institutions doing that. So, you know, when you reached out to say, hey, you want to do this podcast? Of course, I will do anything for the Mental Health Center of Greater Manchester. People get annoyed because I'm always, no matter where I am, I'm like, yeah, Mental Health Center of Greater Manchester is the best. So,
well, you know, your work and your bravery was part of that. Your work with us, you spoke truth to power and really sort of tried to keep us as a system accountable. I mean, I will say personally that, and I will say this long after I retire, I think the best thing we ever did as a center in my 30 years here was hire peer support specialists on staff. I say it at every opportunity. And really, it's because it really challenged our own internalized stigma here at the center. Peers are living proof that recovery happens, that people in recovery have capability, they have gifts, they have something to offer. And I think that they offer that challenge through example. They challenge those inaccurate, stigmatizing attitudes that people hold about individuals with lived experience. I remember the early conversations that we had around bringing on peers, and it felt a little bit like at the time, like we had staff over here and in this corner, and that there were peers over here in this corner, and how are we going to make it work? You know, like, how does that mean for like our conversations and team meetings and blah, blah, blah? Well, thank God, and I will echo what you said, thank God we have incredible leadership. And it was, our leadership was humble, they were self-reflective, but they were also insistent. They were like, this is going to happen, and we have to make it happen. And it's really what you want. If you expect change, if you expect to cultivate like real acceptance, real understanding, a real ongoing commitment to address stigmatization, you have to have strong leadership. And I feel like also is like every level of the organization needs to also be committed to that. It's really humble. It's a hard ongoing process. You know, I think there has to be an explicit understanding that that's what we're about. It's in our policies and procedures. It's in our language. It's in our resources that we have for clients and for staff. It's in our interactions with clients. It's in our interactions with each other. Our services need to reflect it. Even our presence at community events. Like, we have to have a presence at community events that are aimed at raising awareness and challenging stigma. And we do. Our board and our staff also have to be comprised of individuals with lived experience. And it does. Over 50% of our board has lived experience.
Oh.
You know, I believe that that's the statistic. I could be wrong on that. So that might get scrubbed, but we'll see.
So Behavioral Health News is kind of a journal in New York that every issue focuses on a specific topic. And the latest topic that came out in April is the whole issue, I should say, is about peer support. And I was asked to write an article for that. And so I wrote about addressing workplace stigmatization of peer support workers through institutional courage. So maybe this might be an appropriate way to end since we've been talking about courage and bravery. Yeah, so in my article, I cite some research by researcher Wall and their colleagues. And so the research is about the experiences and challenges of peer support workers. And so a quote from their research is, courage was considered an important personal quality for building genuine relationships. The peer supporters described it took courage to be present and harbor the patient's narratives and never to abdicate from standing up for the patient or the client's perspective. Mm. Peers are shouting out courage as well. Let's dedicate this podcast to our peer support colleagues.
I love it. Well, at the risk of this truly turning into a six-hour podcast, there's probably a lot more that can be said about stigmatization, but I guess for the purposes of the podcast, we could end here, you know. So I want to thank our general audience for tuning into this episode 5 of Mind Your Mentality. But Gretchen, I really truly appreciate you joining us. It's lovely to hear and see you again. I'm seeing Gretchen, by the way, for those of you listening to the podcast, but it's very nice to see Gretchen. And I hope that folks follow us for future content. So until then, take good care of yourselves.